From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Frank Brady is my guest. He has written about Orson Welles, Hugh Hefner, Barbara Streisand, and chess. He was one of the first to write about Bobby Fischer, the chess master. And now he has returned to that subject in his absorbing new book, Endgame: Bobby Fischer's Remarkable Rise and Fall from America's Brightest Prodigy to the Edge of Madness. Frank Brady, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, you knew Bobby Fischer. How did you first meet him?
Well, I had heard about him from one of his chess teachers, Carmine Nigro, who told me that he was teaching this young boy who was a master strength, although he hadn't made the master title as yet. And then I was playing in a tournament in Manhattan on the Upper West Side. I was in my teens, and I saw this young boy who was also playing in the tournament. The games lasted usually around 5 hours, and then there was only about a 45-minute or an hour break in between the next round. And during that time, most people relax or get something to eat or walk around the block. Bobby continued to play chess, and I was watching him. I didn't talk to him at that tournament, but I was watching him, and he was so involved with the game, with his concentration, and some man who was 70 or 75 years old was sort of kibitzing the game, and he was telling Bobby where to move and what to do. And at one point, Bobby spun around and he said, "Please be quiet. This is a chess game." And, you know, he was this child who was, you know, and the man was silenced, you know, and embarrassed. You know, something, I can't say that I thought, oh, this boy is going to end up being world champion or anything like that. But I did recognize, you know, how steadfast and how serious he took the game.
And then at what point did you actually get to know him?
Okay. I was directing a tournament in Asbury Park, New Jersey, right on the boardwalk there, the hotel called the Monterey. And he played. He came with his mother. And again, I didn't really talk to him at that point, but he was one of 125 players. But I watched him play, and I talked with his mother about him, and she kept saying how serious he was. It wasn't until later on, when he was starting to get very good, that his mother came to my office with him, and there he had his little baseball cap on and so forth, and he was very quiet, very pale. I was the business manager of the United States Chess Federation at that point, and she came because she wanted to send Bobby to a tournament. She didn't have the money for transportation or expenses or hotels, and she wondered if the U.S. Chess Federation could help him. And so I talked. That was my actual first formal meeting with Bobby. I talked with him and found out where he wanted to go. I told him I would try to help them, not personally, but through the U.S. Chess Federation if I could. And they came back. They kept coming back from time to time, usually for something to help Bobby pursue his career. And I did get some sponsors to help him over the years. So we got to know each other that way. There was a gap in our age. And then later on, several years later, I was living in Greenwich Village, my wife and I, and Bobby would come and visit, read my chess magazines, sometimes swipe my chess magazine, I would say. If my wife was busy that evening, often Bobby and I would go out for dinner, some restaurant. He loved to eat, and he always ate a lot. And then after eating, we'd go to, there was two chess clubs. One was called the Queen's Pawn, right in Sheridan Square there. We would go there, play some speed chess, and then we'd go over to the Marshall Chess Club, which is the premier chess club in the United States. And he was a member there, and I was a member there. and we'd go there and we'd play speed chess there. And we continued that relationship for, you know, several years.
And did you like him?
That's an interesting question. Yes, I did like him, and we bonded, and I think that he liked me, too. But I must tell you that he was not an easy person to be around. He was argumentative. He once said, "I am always on the attack." And he meant not just on the chessboard. His attacks were not logical debates. It was just, this is what he wanted. You were wrong, he was right, that was the end of it. And he, whatever he wanted to do, he did. I mean, if you were having a meal, he'd say, "I'm finished," and then you'd want to go. And, like, he didn't care whether you were finished. You know, that kind of thing. He marched to his own drummer. And ever since he was, a young child. And that became ingrained in him as we went on.
We're talking with Frank Brady, and he's just written a fabulous book that you guys should be reading right now. It's called Endgame, Bobby Fischer's Remarkable Rise and Fall. Do you think there was something... Well, I mean, you talk about him being at the edge of madness, although to me it seems that he's gone over the edge. But do you think there was something wrong with him? Was he maybe autistic or something like that?
You know, many people have brought that up, and psychologists who knew him, one psychiatrist I know who knew him, said they never saw anything like autism or Asperger's or anything like that.
He was just obnoxious.
Well, yeah, in a sense he was. He was. He could be extremely obnoxious. He had a fabulous memory, you know, which sometimes goes with autism.
Mm-hmm.
His IQ was 180. He could memorize, at one point he memorized all of the moves in a book of games of Boris Spassky, and almost as a parlor game, he would hand you the book and say, you know, pick out a game. So you would say, okay, Spassky, Bronstein, Havana, 1961. And he'd say, okay. He would then rattle off the moves. He had memorized 10,000 moves in that book.
It's incredible.
It was absolutely incredible. He, in order to better his game, he learned foreign languages. You know, I wouldn't say he was totally fluent in every one of them, but he knew enough so that he could read the games, and he could read the annotations and the comments by the players through books. So, and his mother was a polymath. She knew six languages, and so she helped him with his languages. But eventually he did master enough of Russian, German, Spanish. I think that might be it.
I remember in your book where he berates a friend who says, "I haven't read it, it's in Russian."
Yeah, well, that was me, by the way. He asked me if I had read Bronstein's book. Bronstein wrote this great tournament book, and I said, "What?" I said, "It's in Russian." He said, "Well, learn it." And he was only, a teenager at that point. But, you know, he took the game very seriously. More seriously than anybody that I have ever met. And I'm totally involved in the game and have been all my life.
Well, and that's fascinating to me, too, the whole, world of chess, which, I cannot play chess. I mean, I can lose if I'm playing someone.
Can't we all?
Yeah, if I'm playing someone who knows how to play, then they will beat me in, like, two moves. And otherwise, I know, if I'm playing against a computer or something, it beats me in a couple of moves. But I can't even really play checkers that well. But, or Parcheesi or any of those. But the whole world of chess is fascinating to me. But with Bobby Fischer, although he kind of becomes Greta Garbo in the second half of your book, he's more like Muhammad Ali in the first half.
Yes.
And that whole, it really is like an athletic sport, and he's in training. And I even thought of Mike Tyson when Tyson was younger,
when he, you know, examined the fight films at Customato's house of all those brilliant fights, and he really memorized those fights in the same way that...
Absolutely. There is a connection there. I mean, you're the first person that's ever mentioned that, but I've thought of that, and I've never talked to anyone about it, but, you know, if you asked Tyson anything about boxing, he would know it.
Yeah.
He knew the whole history of the game. He knew what punch knocked out so-and-so, and whether it was a right hook or whatever it was. And you could do the same thing with Fisher. Fisher, once, I write about this in the book, we were having dinner, and I asked him how he was going to prepare for a tournament. He pulled out his little pocket chess set and came and sat next to me in my side of the booth. And he started going over game after game after game after game, showing me how it was actually preparing for Bronstein, who he had a great respect, almost a fear of, because he thought he was one of the great players, as he was, in the world. And he pulled out games from the 1800s, from his memory, games from the 1900s. It was an incredible moment. And as I write in the book, I watched him. After a while, he sort of lapsed into a reverie, virtually. He was unaware that I was even there, and he was talking, well, if I move my bishop here, he can block those squares, and I know this, and he was going on and on, talking to himself, playing over with this little tiny pocket set, hardly larger than an index card, and I actually began to weep. Because I realized, I had seen him play in tournaments, but never with this intensity. And I realized I was in the presence of genius. I mean, this was absolute genius. This was like watching Mozart compose, or Beethoven compose. It was an incredible moment, because not only could he remember these moves from 100 years before, or 2 weeks before, that he had gleaned from a Russian periodical or something, but that he was analyzing them also as he was doing this, deciding, you know, oh, this is no good, this may be very strong, or whatever. It was a great moment. I wish I had had a motion picture camera. But
you've got it in your head, fortunately.
Yeah, I do.
And you paint a beautiful picture of it in Endgame. Let me ask you this. I think that chess might have been bad for him. That is, if he hadn't become so obsessed with chess, although he eventually married, maybe, might he have been a more successful person?
Well, it depends on what you mean. You know, some people think he was almost an idiot savant. By the way, he was not. He did know other things.
Mm-hmm.
And later on in his life, he became a voracious reader. And he became an intellectual, although distorted in some ways, many ways. But no, I mean, you know, I don't think chess is what made him mad, if you would, or push him to the edge of madness, as I say. But I think it made him saner. And if you talk to certain musicians and certain artists or certain people who, doctors even, who have spent their entire life learning their craft and learning their art and learning their science, often they don't know anything about anything else either. So Bobby spent 6 to 8 to 10 to 12 hours a day for many, many years studying chess. You know, there's a thing, I didn't even put this in the book, I don't think, but story that I remember, that at one point he was having trouble figuring out a particular rook and pawn ending. You don't have to know chess to understand what I'm saying right now, but it's in the endgame. Not my book, The Endgame, but in the actual endgame. He was having trouble figuring it out, and he realized he had to have utmost concentration. And this was not during a tournament. This was during his study. And he didn't want to be called on the telephone. He didn't want to be bothered by his mother or his sister or anything. And so he checked into a hotel room with his chessboard and chess set and spent the entire weekend by himself studying that one position until he had mastered it.
Hmm.
So that should he ever encounter it in a game 2 weeks down the line or 20 years down the line, he would know how to play it.
Well, not knowing a lot about chess, Frank Brady, how likely is it that he would encounter that specific move?
In that particular case, it was likely.
Uh-huh.
It was quite likely that he might encounter it.
Well, what about the world of chess? Now, you were just mentioning that there's a tournament in New Jersey. Is there gambling in chess? Were people betting on... was there a line?
Well, people do gamble on chess. I mean, you can go into some of the parks, like in New York or Washington Square Park, and they play for $1 a game or even $5 a game and stuff like that. So there's that kind of gambling, but there's usually no big gambling. In tournaments, there are cash prizes, and people, you know, if you win the first prize, you can win $5,000 or whatever, $10,000, whatever the case may be, for weekend of work.
Bobby Fischer made a fortune, although he gave a lot of it away and squandered some of it. What about the average chess player? I mean, what about you? Could you make a living at chess?
No, absolutely not. I'm not that good. And, you know, I played Bobby hundreds of games, and, you know, only when he gave me odds did I ever win maybe two out of hundreds, and that's when he gave me odds. So, no, I'm not in that same universe. There are very few people, for instance, in the United States that actually make a living from tournament earnings. There are professional chess players, but where they make their living is by teaching, you know, charging $50, $60, $70, $80, $100 an hour to teach people.
Mm-hmm.
They write books. Some of them own chess parlors, that kind of thing, chess clubs, and write articles and so forth. But the actual cash prizes, there's very few people. I know a few who are eking out a living. And I say eking out, you know, I don't know how much they make during the course of the year, but, you know, probably not more than 30 or 40,000, or maybe less than that.
Huh.
And they just eke it. And I know very few people that even can do that.
Well, I guess the most fascinating part of your story, and I guess the thing that compelled you to write a new book about Bobby Fischer, is the fact that he pulled a Greta Garbo and not only walked away, but really walked away from everything.
Yeah, and that was the strangest thing. I mean, at one point when he played Spassky and became the first American to win the world's championship, and he was on the cover of Time, Life, Newsweek, Sports Illustrated, Look, all these magazines, the front page of every newspaper in the world, that here this kid from Brooklyn, without any governmental help, defeated the Soviet hegemony, in a sense, with Spassky having trainers and psychologists and the whole government behind him. He was, at that moment in time, one of the most famous people on earth. And when he came back to New York, he was greeted on the steps of City Hall by Mayor Lindsay and given a gold medal, and Bobby Fischer Day was proclaimed in New York. He was offered a ticker tape parade, and he refused it. He said, no, I don't want it. But he did receive the medal. And he had, his lawyer had $10 million worth of offers of sponsorship of products, appearance fees, tournament fees. And Bobby spurned it all. And I try to come to terms with that. I try to explain that in the book. And it was a combination of many different things. One thing is he was very true to himself in terms of he would never agree to sponsor a product unless he actually had used that product. So even if it was something like, well, we'll give you the new automobile, Bobby, and then you can use the new automobile, and then you can sponsor the product, he felt that was cheating. It would only be if he owned the automobile to begin with would he agree to sponsor it. And he didn't own an automobile. So that was one part of it. Secondly, he did have, and there was a growing paranoia there, which he had all of his life. He always felt that if someone offered him $10,000 for a sponsorship deal, that they really had $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 available. And so he started to try to drive hard bargains, and he often lost because maybe that money was not available.
Well,
and he felt the whole idea of sponsorship was undignified. He just didn't want to get involved in it.
I guess the most shocking thing in your book is his reaction to the attacks of 9/11.
Oh, absolutely. It was ridiculous. The thing that one should know, and I go into it in the book, is that in 1976, he had a law case against Time Life International and a writer for Time that he had signed a contract with to give that writer access to write a series of articles in Life magazine, which he did. The writer was a very, very good writer, and Bobby gave him full access to himself. But the contract specifically said that there would not be a book written about him. Bobby wanted to preserve that for himself, and the contract was actually broken because the man did write a book, and it was quite a vicious look at Bobby, I might say. Although, again, well written.
Was it accurate or inaccurate?
There were parts of, let's say, exaggerations.
Okay.
I like to say that it was a combination of the National Enquirer meets the New Yorker. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well versed, but too sensational. And so Bobby went to court and sued Time Life and sued this writer for $100 million. And because he began not to trust lawyers, because he had some bad experience with lawyers, he tried the case himself, and it was thrown out of court. And at that point, he said, I'm never going to pay taxes again, nor did he ever in his life for all those years later. I will never pay taxes again, and I do not believe in the whole jurisprudence of the United States court system, and I do not believe in America. It's corrupt. So this is what was in his mind for many years. And when 9/11 happened, he applauded the act. His theory was that the United States was an illegal government, that the America belonged to the Native Americans, and it should be given back to the Native Americans.
Hmm.
Well, when I heard this, I lived not too far from Ground Zero, and from a month or more, maybe 2 months later, I could still smell the burning rubble. And my university was right near there. We lost people in the 9/11, but so it was very personal to me. And I just went ballistic when I heard it, when Bobby made those comments. And I just didn't want anything to do with him as a result of that.
Did you ever see him again?
Never saw him again. But what happened was I gave a talk on his life and career and his games at the Marshall Chess Club in New York, and someone put it on YouTube. Someone just told me it's no longer on YouTube. I don't know how that happens, but it went on YouTube, and apparently Bobby saw it. He was on his deathbed. I had no idea, and I had told a few anecdotes about him in the talk, and he told a third party. Get in touch with Brady and tell him, make mention of this one particular funny anecdote. And it was sort of, people saw that as a sort of a reaching out to me from him. And okay, I could accept that to some extent.
Were you shocked or surprised when he died?
I was, totally. Because someone told me that he was ill. Someone told me he had been in the hospital and he was out. But I had no idea that he was gravely ill. And I was definitely shocked.
Yeah, I think one of the most compelling things in your book is the dust jacket, which shows the beautiful, young, athletic Bobby Fischer on the front and what looks like a 1,000-year-old troll on the back.
Yes. And, you know, he's only in that picture on the back, he's only in his early 60s, and yet he looks like a man in his 90s. But, of course, he was already ill, and he had just gotten out of prison. He had been in there for 9 months for trying to fly on an invalid passport, and he was in a Japanese prison. So, he hadn't shaved, and he really looked bad. But he had an encroaching illness.
Your book leaves us hanging on a couple of issues, and I wonder
sure.
if there's still, what's happening with his estate? Has that been?
Well, it's since I speak to Iceland all the time, and this is where he lived for 3 years. There was a number of people were claiming the money to his estate, and he did not leave a will. And so who were they? His wife, Miyoko Wate, a Japanese woman. The question is, was he really married to her? She claimed that they were married while he was in prison. And she had a certificate to that extent. At first, the certificate was not accepted because it was a Xerox copy. But apparently since then she has produced the original copy. Secondly, his two nephews, his sister's boys, both claimed the estate. And thirdly, a woman in the Philippines claimed that he had a child, a little girl, by her, and she was claiming the estate for the little girl. Now, I should say, fourthly, the United States government was claiming
they want some tax money
for the back taxes and
yeah.
so forth. So it turned out that his body was exhumed and a DNA test was taken to either prove or not prove that he was the father of this Philippine child. And it turned out he was not. So they're out of the case. And now, just in this past week, it has gone up to Reykjavik District Court again to determine whether or not that marriage certificate is real and authentic. If it indeed is, then the wife of the dead person, of the husband, gets the full amount of the estate. If it's not, then the two nephews would get it. But then, of course, there's always the Internal Revenue Service in the background waiting to take whatever is left. He had gotten $3.5 million playing in a rematch with Spassky, violating the sanctions that the American government had against Serbia. So that's a whole other story I go into in the book. But he, during that time from 1992 up until he died in 2008, he had spent about $1.5 million. But so he still had $2 million left in the estate.
Well, Frank Brady, the book is called Endgame, Bobby Fischer's Remarkable Rise and Fall, From America's Brightest Prodigy to the Edge of Madness. It's a great book, and I thank you for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, I appreciate the talk.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Frank Brady. His book, Endgame, Bobby Fischer's remarkable rise and fall, from America's brightest prodigy to the edge of madness. I also want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.